Vice President J.D. Vance is expected to host senior administration officials for a dinner tonight at his residence to discuss the administration's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein case. This comes one day after the House Oversight Committee subpoenaed the Justice Department for files in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking investigation. The committee's Republican chairman, James R. Comer, said he wants the full, complete, unredacted Epstein files on or before August 19th. The committee also issued subpoenas for depositions with former President Bill Clinton, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and eight former top law enforcement officials. The committee is seeking information about Epstein's connections to prominent figures, including President Trump. Should DOJ fail to turn over the files, it could set up a high-profile clash between the Trump administration and Congress. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shairana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shairana Show. We're going to start with a little clip that connects what's happening in Sudan with the Congo, with Gaza. And this clip is really goes to what we've been saying since October 2023, which is that the Gaza issue is the litmus test for global justice. And this short clip here really summarizes why the importance of Gaza to all those struggles, especially when Sudan is not being reported on, when the famine is just as bad as the one in Gaza. Let's have a listen.
The reason why Gaza is such an outrage is not because what is happening to Gaza is the worst thing that has ever happened to humanity, or is the worst thing that is happening to humanity as we speak. Sudan has been at the fifth stage of starvation for a year. Gaza just got to the fifth stage of starvation. What makes Gaza so gruesome, so awful, is that it is televised. The world cannot pretend like they don't know anymore. It's not somewhere isolated in Africa where the few with black skin that are able to get out are screaming at the top of their lungs, hoping that somebody will hear them. Everybody knows about Gaza. Gaza is a case study on what human beings will do when it is unquestionable that people are suffering immensely. It is the hope that Africa has been holding on. It is the hope that Africa has been fighting for, that if we could just get people to pay attention, if we could just get people to see our suffering, if we could just get people to see us, then it will be over. Gaza disproves that directly. It severs the hope of millions of people for so many generations. That's why Gaza is so gruesome. That's why Gaza is so awful. It televises children, 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 babies being eliminated in the worst ways ever. Their pictures, their videos, everything, mass scale. Everybody knows. Everybody's seeing it. And this is the best the world can come up with. That's what makes this so bad. It tells us the current state of humanity, the definition of humanity. That's what this case study is showing us. As of this timeline in humanity, humans have not evolved to a point where they're motivated enough to stop suffering for the sake of suffering, it means that humanity has not reached what I would describe as herd empathy. And we're not evolved enough to be able to stop suffering, not even if it is the most vulnerable class of people. Children, babies, it's right in front of us. We're not motivated enough. We're not evolved enough to stop our own suffering. We cannot hide behind the term humanity anymore, because this is humanity. We are seeing humanity, and it is sad. Because now, where is hope for the people who are waiting their turn, who have been suffering for much longer than Gaza? Where is the hope? If Gaza cannot get the help that they need, even now, when it is televised at such a mass scale, when people all over the world are crying for it to stop, if they cannot stop the suffering, they are on the fifth phase of starvation, and it is still going. There's still children that will die tonight. What hope does the rest of the world have? What hope does Sudan have? What hope does Congo have? That's what makes it so gruesome.
So that's what makes it so gruesome indeed. And if, I mean, there are people who claim that if you let this happen to Gaza without any resistance, without stopping it, without figuring out how to stop it, then the ruling class and the billionaires, which rule the world right now, as we've seen demonstrated, as because the masks are off of our government, over our institutes of higher education, they are all run by these billionaires, by these oligarchs. We don't have democracies in the West. We have oligarchies all over, and then we have these dictatorships in the East, in the Middle East, if you want to call it that, in the Arab world, to be more specific, that are basically colonized, remotely colonized by these Western powers, especially the United States. One thing we're seeing right now is in Lebanon, where we have the United States, Saudi Arabia, working, and of course the corrupt Lebanese government, working together to basically instigate a civil war in Lebanon so that the Lebanese resistance can be pressured to drop its weaponry, the only weapons of defense that the country has, because we certainly don't have a military. And we've had, you know, political prisoners arrested by Lebanese intelligence that are that as a part of the intimidation into weakening the Lebanese resistance there, the only defenders basically of the nation, capable of defending the nation. So we have also the United States building the largest embassy, largest American embassy that that exists right now. If they finish this project, on a hill in Beirut, in a country the size of Rhode Island, if you want to imagine that, what that looks like, which will be essentially a spying satellite for the United States and for and of course for Israel. At the same time, we're still seeing the world turn right now, belatedly, 22 months into the genocide, in terms of at least in lip service against Israel. And we've seen some of the manifestations of this, where we have Western countries saying we recognize Palestine, and presenting a two-state solution, which is laughable, because the two-state solution is been long dead. You know, when just to give you an example, with South Africa under apartheid, when, you know, The solution wasn't a two-state solution. Imagine if we had a two-state solution in South Africa, where you have the apartheid racist government ruling with Mandela's government. That's what a two-state solution would look like right now in Palestine. But the fact that these countries, these Western countries, people like Prime Minister Starmer, the Canadian Prime Minister saying that we're going to recognize Palestine if you don't stop the deliberate starvation of Palestinians. This is about not really anything solid that's going to come out of this. This is about them covering their behinds, to sort of speak. And because the solution is not recognizing a Palestine that's being genocided, but it's stopping the genocide. So what they're doing is they're covering that. The other thing they're doing to cover, and this is a common among liberal Zionists like J Street and others, is like blaming Netanyahu and the Monsters Inc. that rule Israel right now. These settlers that have moved in and created a government, a shadow government to the real Israeli government, and now it's completely infiltrated. The government is filled with settlers and controlled by settlers. That's the issue right there. The what we have, it's not recognizing this, but and they're trying to shift, to put it in short, they're trying to shift the responsibility of the state of Israel, which doesn't really they keep asking people to divert from the issue. Do you believe that Israel should exist? And I like Zohran Mamdani's answer, which is it does exist. And the question is, should people exist? It's, people have the right to exist. States don't have the right to exist, especially if they are an occupying apartheid ethno-state that is basically a colonial outpost for the West. So they're trying to divert the responsibility of the state of Israel to just Netanyahu, which means, and his government, of course, but which means that when Netanyahu goes away, if he ever goes away, they'll say, okay, now we're back to normal, and we're not accountable to anything that happened under his government. And the reality is they are accountable. They've been accountable since October 7, and they were accountable 70 years before October 7. So don't buy the hype about this recognizing Palestine. We need recognition. We need them to feed the people. We need them to stop killing the people. We need them to stop the genocide. We need to have them stop arming, providing the gun to kill Palestinians, whether it's Canada, France, or the United States, or the European Union, and specifically Germany. Which brings me to Germany, where they're still acting like the Nazis that they were in terms of the government and the police. And I discovered lately that the reason why Germany is doing this is because they have twice the police force that any other European nation has. So they have an endless supply of cops to suppress any kind of dissent and to apply their new anti-Semitism in this case, the Semitic people are both anti-Zionist Jews and Muslims and Christians and atheists, etc., that they're suppressing. The last thing I wanted to say is about the there's now recently the Zapatistas, which we'll hear about in a second. The Zapatistas are becoming a model to look at again right now. And I say again because when we were involved in the anti-globalization movement, we were looking, our slogan was Another world is possible. For those of you who weren't born at the turn of the millennium, there was a very active anti-globalization movement, very dynamic, that was really destroyed with 9/11, because governments used 9/11 to suppress the anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movement. But the Zapatistas are being looked at because they are right now, all our powers through government, all our funding, including the recent declaration by Trump, that if a state does boycotts Israel, then they will not be entitled to any kind of assistance in the case of disasters. Basically, if you don't support Israel, we're not going to save you from floods or hurricanes. So that shows you, nothing shows you that all along the Trump administration hasn't been about America first. It's been about Israel first, because that's the, again, the outpost for this colonial power, an important outpost. That's why Biden used to say, if there wasn't an Israel, we would have invented it, because they needed that outpost, because they did invent it, them and Britain and France. The last thing I wanted to say is that the tide is still turning. You see, the Australia just had over 300,000 protesters that marched through the capital of Sydney over the major bridge there. We've had recently Japan, right before it commemorates the Hiroshima bombings and the Nagasaki bombings, massive demonstrations there. We've seen Greece, the government of Greece, and the mayor of Athens specifically, confront Israel when they try to play victim because of some anti-Israeli graffiti that was written. And the mayor basically, the mayor of Athens answered back with a very tough statement, saying, you are hypocrites for complaining about this while you're killing women and children and men in Palestine. So we're still having this turn, and the turn continues, but we're still having one of the darkest moments, which Ilan Pappe and others, these brilliant Jewish scholars, that have predicted that we're going to go through the darkest moment before we arrive at the light at the end of the tunnel, a very long tunnel, a very dark tunnel at that. So with that, I just wanted to, with the Zapatistas thing, I wanted to do a little Zapatistas 101 to provide it as a model for us right now, in order to what to do in the long run, while our rights are being taken, while the government is being any kind of assistance from the government is being taken away, and how to form a communal entity that confronts the state. So let's have a listen about the Zapatistas.
Talk about the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. Now, they are an indigenous political and militant group that seized a substantial amount of territory in the southernmost state of Mexico from the Mexican government. The Zapatista political organizing principle, known as Neo-Zapatismo, synthesizes Maya tradition with elements of libertarian socialism, anarchism, Catholic liberation theory, and Marxism. Now, this group was way ahead of its time, but actually right on time when it comes to organizing using indigenous principles. Recognizing that Spanish is a colonial language embedded with colonial biases about gender, they start using gender-neutral Spanish, replacing the O's and the A's in their written communication with the at symbol. They also created poems and stories using Maya mythopoetic techniques. So they blended indigenous storytelling techniques with political messaging and magical realism in order to spread their message.
On January 1st, 1994, they declare war on the U.S. government and the Mexican government. And along with their declaration of war, they also released what's known as Women's Revolutionary Law. This law codified women's rights in the movement, including the rights to reproductive justice, freedom from harm, the right to pursue education, and the right to participate in societies at all level and in all levels of government. About a third of the Zapatista Army's militant group is women. To put that into perspective, that would be twice the percentage of women in the U.S. military. Today, the Zapatista autonomous zones have their own systems for banks, education, food, and health. They refuse all help from the Mexican government. There is no wage work in their communities, and all the items that are necessary for living are communally distributed.
We have this situation where we are going to depend on ourselves because the government is shedding all responsibility to protect us. And that's why the Zapatistas don't apply, of course, one-to-one with us. But we have to look at historic examples where basically the people seceded from a corrupt government and a criminal government at that, and succeeded in building their own community. The other thing I wanted to share with you today is this long clip in terms of what's happening with the Epstein files right now, which is really important, which is an issue that's not going away. But here, Max Blumenthal, this interview with Max Blumenthal, what it does, it really ties what's happening with the Epstein files and how that's tied with the disenchantment with Israel in the US. So let's have a listen to the interview with Max Blumenthal about the Epstein files.
Everyone, we're joined again by Max Blumenthal, the editor-in-chief at The Gray Zone, to discuss the Epstein files and the extent to which this could split Trump's MAGA base. So welcome back.
Good to be back. Good to see you.
So these Epstein files, they seemed like a very important part of Trump's whole campaign of draining the swamp. Yet he moved away from it, and now he seems, let's say very defensive, as he seemingly attempts to bury the whole story. Indeed, he comes off as a man who has something to hide, even though, of course, I don't have any evidence for this. But I was wondering, what do you make of this shift in rhetoric and the behavior around the Epstein files, or alleged files?
Well, we've seen everything thrown at Trump, including a massive legal assault accusing him of sexually assaulting E. Jean Carroll. There was the Stormy Daniels case where the district attorney U.S. attorney, no, district attorney in New York accused Trump of his team of fixing the books to cover up his affair with a porn actor, Stormy Daniels. Then there was the whole a Trump-Russia collusion hoax. It was definitely a hoax. It was something I was calling out at the Gray Zone along with Aaron Maté from the beginning. We were sort of isolated voices, not within MAGA or Trump's camp, calling that out. And none of it really stuck. For one, the Russiagate collusion pseudo-scandal didn't stick because the Mueller investigation found that there was no collusion. And now the Trump administration is taking advantage of that to do two things. One, to punish their political enemies, Trump's predecessors from the Clinton and Obama camps, and to distract from the Epstein scandal with this massive drop of Russiagate-related documents. But the point I'm making here is none of these scandals stuck because Trump, unlike every other American politician in my lifetime, commanded this loyal cult-like following within his base that would have followed him if he had switched political parties. Or, as he said, if he had shot a man in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York, they would have still followed him. But suddenly Trump's mystique has been broken over the Epstein files, the Epstein client list, and his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The QAnon shaman, I don't know if you remember him. He's one of the most notorious figures from the January 6th Capitol riot. He just yesterday went on Twitter X and declared F Trump and F Israel. This is part of the phenomenon that Trump is facing from within his own base. And it comes from a part of Trump's base which loathes the political establishment, doesn't have maybe the most high level of political education, but sees a kind of elite that work together across political parties who don't play by the same rules. And they decided to accuse them of the most severe thing, the most immoral, diabolical thing you could possibly do, which is pedophilia. And they referred to them as the pedophile elite. We saw various conspiracy theories consume parts of Trump's base that would keep them aligned with Trump, with the belief that Donald Trump would eventually crack down on the pedophile elite, first through QAnon, which was spawned by a Telegram influencer named Ron Watkins, who I think is former military intelligence, with these Q drops that showed that that would illustrate how Trump was going to take on the pedophile elite. Then there was the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, which was based on really strange Instagram posts from and unusual emails that came out in the Podesta files, which implicated in the minds of many Trump followers, people close to Hillary Clinton, as pedophiles who were molesting children in the tunnels and secret passageways underneath a popular restaurant in Northwest Washington, D.C. called Comet Ping Pong. And those all manifested as kind of anti-establishment conspiracy theories that were all leading up to something big. And, you know, within QAnon circles, what people would say was a storm is coming. And they would, there were QAnon songs by Creedence Clearwater Revival about, you know, who will stop the rain. And it was a reference to sort of a cryptic reference to who will stop the pedophile elite. And eventually they're all going to be washed away in this giant storm. And the storm was going to come when Trump came back into office, after surviving miraculously an assassination attempt, very strange assassination attempt in which he apparently survived by a millimeter and seemed to have been blessed by God in the eyes of his followers to carry out some kind of holy mission. They actually saw this billionaire figure who had been fully invested in the social circles of the elite in New York City throughout his political life and had boasted of having sexual relations with young women during Howard Stern interviews, had talked about overseeing, you know, being part of the party planning of these notorious all-white parties that P. Diddy would host in the Hamptons. All white meaning everyone wears white, and then they, you know, they're also known as freak-offs. But Trump boasted about that as early as 2000. So he was up in that world, and this is something that I knew, that people who really knew who Trump was knew, but his base actually saw a different figure that had been marketed to him. And then, so it had been marketed to them through these more underground conspiracy theories, but also through more like astroturfed high-level Trump influencers like Dan Bongino, who is the now deputy director of the FBI. And Bongino was constantly promising Trump's base, who were his, you know, who is his audience on Rumble, that there would be some giant drop of Epstein files, that the Epstein files had been obtained. Then Pam Bondi comes in, someone who is as much of a swamp creature as anyone, had lobbied for every slime bag corporation and foreign governments. And she promises that she declares in an interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News that she has the Epstein files on her desk, that there are witness, there are accuser testimonies. I think she might have said hundreds of accuser testimonies. So this created massive, for years, there was just this massive anticipation among Trump's base. And then all of a sudden, Trump just slams the door in their face. Pam Bondi declares she doesn't even want to talk about Epstein in press conferences. And Trump, as you said, seems like he has something to hide. And this occurs at a time when Donald Trump had been betraying his base on many other promises, and at a time when the right, the political right in the U.S., the America First movement, is beginning to wake up on the issue of Israel. And so Jeffrey Epstein and the Epstein files become kind of a catch-all for every Trump betrayal. And it correctly fuels the sense that Donald Trump is actually part of the deep state, part of the swamp, that he actually had very close relationships with this so-called pedophile elite, which I see sort of, I would call them like a decadent hovercraft elite. And now Donald Trump is getting his ass kicked left and right by the Democrats over this, and by many of his own influencers. I mean, I mentioned the QAnon shaman. Now CNN is playing Nick Fuentes, who, you know, previously supported, like he was seen as supportive of Trump, but he's more like he sort of presents himself as the purest America First influencer. And CNN is playing these clips of Nick Fuentes going off on Trump, just tearing Trump to shreds. So for the first time, we're actually seeing Trump's mystique being broken, and he will never be able to recover that mystique. So this is the most, whatever you think of the substance of the Epstein scandal, this is the most significant scandal of the Trump era, because it's the first one to actually scathe him.
It does, just from his persona, the way he speaks now, it does seem as if he's under immense stress or pressure. But one of his skills, though, as you suggested, has been to manage the media. He can, well, if there's been whatever was in the news today, he can put something else in the news tomorrow. And yep. But it doesn't seem to be working this time. I mean, he tried to dismiss the Epstein files as, he used the word boring. And, you know, he's been dead for a long time. You know, why are you even talking about this? Even going after his own base, telling, oh, I don't need you, trashing them. quite remarkable. I think maybe he bought into the whole notion that he was, untouchable. But one thing that I thought was strange is the way he keeps linking it to the Russiagate hoax. I mean, this, again, was a real hoax. It was pushed by the Democrats. But now he's saying that the Epstein files are a Democrat hoax. So why is he pushing these two issues together? Or is it just trying to benefit or shift the narrative? Or how do you read this?
He's insulting the intelligence of his base and his followers. He thinks that they're so dumb that they'll actually believe that Hillary Clinton and Obama wrote the Epstein files in order to embarrass Trump, and that they won't look any further. And these sorts of deflections have worked in the past, partly because the Clintonites and Obama camp have weaponized mis and disinformation against Donald Trump so much in the past. But I think, you know, this is a different era, and younger people who supported Donald Trump or voted for him can clearly see through this. There's so much more to it. As I said, this is a catch-all for various other betrayals, and the biggest betrayal among many younger right-wingers is just the whole concept. They feel like the whole concept of America First has been betrayed by Donald Trump, because they see him not only rearming Zelensky and turning his back on his vow to end the Ukraine proxy war, but also being controlled by Netanyahu, being controlled by this foreign state that operates through the same kind of circles that Jeffrey Epstein operated within, that influences Trump through those circles of Zionist billionaires. Jeffrey Epstein, was the money manager for Les Wexner, who is one of the most powerful Zionist billionaires in the U.S. He basically owns half of downtown Columbus, Ohio. He is the head of the board of trustees for Ohio State University. Even after he had to resign from his position as CEO of Victoria's Secret, which was his main company, over his very close relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, Ohio State couldn't dislodge Wexner because he had contributed so much money to the school that he was basically indispensable. And Epstein, what he was doing was like offshoring money for Wexner and in the Virgin Islands. So he would pay no taxes. And then then Epstein would get all these gifts from Wexner, like a townhouse in the middle of New York City, a luxury townhouse for nothing. His neighbor, Jeffrey Epstein's neighbor in that townhouse, who bought his townhouse through a shell company controlled by Wexner and Epstein, was Howard Lutnick, who was at the time the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald. And Howard Lutnick is now Trump's commerce secretary. So it's pretty bad optics when Donald Trump goes out there and insults his base on the tarmac when he's about to get into Air Force One, and Howard Lutnick is standing right there next to him. Howard Lutnick is also very influential in the Chabad-Lubavitch cult, which has very close links to the Israeli settler movement and backs many of the messianic fascistic figures in Netanyahu's coalition. So it all feeds into this sense that Trump is hiding something about his ties to Israeli intelligence. Tucker Carlson came out at TPUSA, which is the big gathering of conservative youth hosted by someone named Charlie Kirk, whose career, he was basically conservative child influencer. Ever since he was a teenager, he's been on the track to basically lead the conservative movement. His career was completely fueled by pro-Israel money, by Zionist money. And Charlie Kirk suddenly finds himself presiding over a conference where Tucker Carlson, the keynote speaker, the most influential speaker, gets up and says Jeffrey Epstein was Israeli intelligence, and that's why Trump is covering this up. And something that I've never seen happen before took place as a result of that. The Israelis themselves got frightened by Epstein. A domestic U.S. scandal actually frightened the Israelis. And Naftali Bennett, the former Israeli prime minister, was summoned to declare that he, as prime minister, dealt every day with the Mossad, and Jeffrey Epstein did not work for the Mossad, was not a Mossad agent. And then he threatens Tucker Carlson and said, "We won't stand for this." Another Israeli intelligence-connected figure, Amichai Chikli, who is the Minister of Diaspora Affairs, also denounced Tucker Carlson and issued a veiled warning to Charlie Kirk, because Israel has so much leverage over Charlie Kirk, having funded his career. And it's all like this whole relationship between Israel and the conservative movement is cracking up over Jeffrey Epstein. It's amazing to see it. And it suggests that there actually is something there. There definitely is something there. Now, I cannot say that Jeffrey Epstein is a Mossad agent, but he traveled in circles, in Zionist circles. And if he were alive today and had not been jailed and was a free man, he would have been involved with all of these Zionist billionaires in threatening to defund Ivy League universities that allow Palestine solidarity protests. He would have been part of that world. So this is, I think, one of the reasons why Epstein threatens the movement or threatens the elites around Donald Trump, and why they're seeking to bury the files, as well as the fact that Donald Trump has had a very close personal relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And there may be photos of Donald Trump in a compromising position, as the journalist Michael Wolff, who knew Jeffrey Epstein, who spent time with Jeffrey Epstein, who interviewed Jeffrey Epstein for many hours, has said. Michael Wolff has said, and I mean, he's been shown to be unreliable in the past, but he has said that the FBI seized photos, including one showing Donald Trump with topless girls by Epstein's pool sitting on his lap, seized those from Jeffrey Epstein's safe. And that's what the Epstein files are. There are also 16 hours of footage recorded by Steve Bannon, Trump's former chief of staff, And he's basically refused to release those 16 hours of footage of him and Jeffrey Epstein having friendly conversations and interviews. And Bannon was very close to Epstein for many years. And one, I think they both were united on their hatred for Donald Trump. That's what I think Michael Wolff has said. So I think there are two things going on here. There's the geopolitical danger of Jeffrey Epstein to the special relationship with Israel. And there's the personal relationship that Donald Trump enjoyed, in which Trump appears to have been compromised by.
Well, I thought that almost was established that he was a Mossad agent, but the main operation was to get politicians, businessmen in compromising position in order to extort favors for influence. But if he's not Mossad or a agent of Israel, at least how else is his background being explained, or do we know anything else about his associations?
I mean, what we know is that he had very close relationships with figures who functioned as kind of like Israeli intelligence assets or Israeli cutouts in the United States. I mean, the way that Israel operates in the U.S. is different than the way, I don't know, Russian intelligence would operate or any other foreign intelligence service. Like, they work through the American Jewish establishment and the American Jewish power elite in a very open way. And the way the Mossad operates is, I know this through a mutual friend who worked on Wall Street, who knew a major American-Israeli investment banker, someone who ran their own firm, who was a Mossad cutout. And he would boast that the Mossad would ask him, because he had so much liquid assets, they'd say, we're going to do a black operation in a third country, and we need you to deposit this much money in this shell account now, and we will pay you back later, and we can't tell you what it's for, but you're an Israeli patriot, so do this. And he would just do it. I don't want to say who they are, because I don't want to get sued or anything. But what I'm saying is the relationship between Israeli intelligence or the Israeli state is very fluid and unregulated in the U.S. This other character I mentioned to you who threatened Tucker Carlson, Amichai Chikli, he is the Minister of Diaspora Affairs. And there's a great investigative series by the journalists Jack Paulson and Lee Fong on how he has been circumventing America's Foreign Agent Registration Act, which requires foreign governments to register their lobbyists and their lobbyists to report on their activities and meetings to the Department of Justice. And what Chikli has been doing is, instead of, while the Israeli government is like paying influencers in the U.S., they've set up a series of NGOs, nonprofits in the U.S., and are working through those and saying, well, this is just American, but the money is foreign. So it's totally unregulated. So how can we evaluate whether Jeffrey Epstein was actually a Mossad agent who was meeting around a glass table with the Mossad chief getting instructions when the relationships are so fluid? What is clear is Jeffrey Epstein would have meetings with very influential foreign officials and salons at his townhouse. One of them was Ehud Barak, who visited about 36 times. Worked with Jeffrey Epstein, I think, to set up a surveillance company or surveillance startup. Ehud Olmert, former Israeli prime minister, also had several meetings with Epstein. Shimon Peres had some meetings with Epstein. Epstein even reportedly set up a meeting for JP Morgan executives with Benjamin Netanyahu. Jeffrey Epstein helped Peter Thiel from Palantir, who has major investments with Israeli intelligence, make enormous amounts of money through an investment. He helped guide his investments. So he had connections with all of these intelligence connected individuals. He applied for multiple passports to travel to the Middle East and Africa. This was reported by CBS News. Jeffrey Epstein went to Israel in 2008 when he was facing his first prosecution for sex trafficking in Florida. And then there's the Daily Beast report, which claimed that Alex Acosta, the Florida prosecutor, was told to back off Epstein because he, quote unquote, belonged to intelligence. I don't know if that's dependable, a dependable report or not. Alex Acosta, by the way, now is in the Trump administration. But it's what we can say is Epstein was intelligence adjacent, and he may have also been adjacent to other intelligence agencies. A Saudi passport was reportedly found in his townhome when after he died or was killed. The last person to meet Jeffrey Epstein, I believe, was William Barr, who is Trump's attorney general. William Barr launched his career in U.S. government as a CIA officer, and he helped write the pardons for the Iran-Contra felons under Reagan and Bush. William Barr's father, Donald Barr, was the headmaster of the Dalton School that first hired Jeffrey Epstein. And Jeffrey Epstein had said to various journalists, including Michael Wolff, that he was afraid of Trump during Trump's first term. Understandably, because he had compromised Trump, and then Epstein was placed in a compromising position in the end in a prison cell. Steve Bannon, who knew him very well, said he believed Jeffrey Epstein was murdered. All of this happens under Trump, with all these figures who have these strange associations with Epstein. So it's no wonder that this scandal only grows, and Trump cannot dismiss it as some giant nothing burger from a long time ago.
Well, when I first saw Trump behaving this manner, I thought either he has to be on this list or he wants to use the list somehow. Yeah, for pressure. But it does appear from all of this that, well, his name are on some of these flight logs, so it does look suspicious. My last question though was just about what this means for the future relationship with Israel, because, for a long time in the United States, it looks as if patriotism has been linked very close to being pro-Israel, in which, it's especially among the conservatives, where this is impossible to say anything critical of Israel. So this is something completely new, it seems to me, that you have people not, so far in the media, at least alternative media, the Candace Owens, the Tucker Carlsons, all of them being very vocal about why are we subordinating our interest to Israel. Again, this is the whole America first. If the US would get out of the Middle Eastern wars, it has to put America above Israel. But do you see this, because I've only seen in the media sphere so far, do you see this having some influence on actual politics?
Well, let's see. There's an interactive poll, a Polymarket interactive poll that just came out on July 21st that's showing that Trump's approval among Americans aged 18 to 29 has gone down from 55 points in early February, which is very high for a U.S. president, especially a Republican. The Democrats typically had commanded the youth in the past. 55% in early February to 28% in July. So a 54-point negative swing for Donald Trump in just those few months. And I think a lot of it has to do with Gaza, with Palestine, with seeing images of shredded babies day after day and associating Trump with that. I mean, this really destroyed Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as well, their association with the Gaza genocide. Young people are paying attention like never before. Yesterday I arrived in New York, or actually just like hours ago, I arrived in New York City, got out of a train, and saw a giant Palestine march proceeding up 7th Ave, and I joined it, and it was stretched several blocks, and you would see in the march very kind of like almost like professional managerial class looking people, like people who had just gotten out of work, normie looking white progressive people who just look like the kind of urban cadre that works in New York City. And as the march proceeded up 7th Ave, people would come out onto the sidewalks to cheer for it. And cars passing by were honking in support. Vendors were cheering in support. Something is going on, and it's like bigger. It is about Palestine, but it's bigger than Palestine. A backlash is taking place. A backlash is taking place in New York City in the form of Zohran Mamdani's mayoral campaign. Kind of a 34-year-old assembly member slash influencer looks set to become the next mayor, and this is someone who favors boycotting Israel, and has said that he would arrest Netanyahu if he arrives in New York City, which is causing this giant meltdown. On the right, you can see there is a total lack of enthusiasm among the America First influencers for Israel, and Epstein for them is the symbol of everything that's wrong with Israel, this kind of corrupt elite that's controlling government in the United States through blackmail. It may be a little too sophisticated for them to make AIPAC that symbol, so Epstein is a convenient symbol, and it's going to play out for a generation. Israel is losing everyone. They're losing Catholics this week, sending out their own Zionist influencers to attack the Pope for condemning an Israeli attack on a Catholic or Orthodox church in Gaza, attacking the Pope, the new Pope Leo, as a kind of Nazi for his condemnation of that. One of the biggest Catholic youth influencers, Michael Knowles, has spoken out for the first time against Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu attempted to curry influence with popular podcasters when he arrived for his last visit to the US. It was his fourth visit this year. He's constantly tending to this relationship that's collapsing, that's fraying at the edges. So the Trump White House set up an interview for Benjamin Netanyahu with the Nelk Boys, who are popular like frat bro type influencer podcasters. As vacuous as they sound, they market like an alcoholic scent seltzer and nicotine packs. There's almost no substance there. Like, their whole podcast is based around, watching them get drunk and play pranks and so on. And the questions for Netanyahu were fed to them by Netanyahu's team, and they asked him, "Do you like the McDon like do you like McDonald's or Burger King? Which do you like better? And like, do you like the Whopper?" And they're asking him these questions while Israel is deliberately starving the children, the people of Gaza. And the images are pouring out of Gaza of skeletal children and skeletal people collapsing in the streets. This becomes a huge scandal for the Nelk Boys. They wind up having to host some of the biggest anti-Israel and even anti-Jewish influencers like Nick Fuentes to mollify their followers. And in a follow-up live stream, they declare that someone had told them that they just interviewed the modern-day Hitler, and that actually seems to be the case. So, I mean, it's all collapsing at the grassroots level, and all Israel has is its established bribery networks like AIPAC to hold on to the elite. And how long can that last?
Well, it is interesting though that after all of this, not just making the Ukraine war his, you're calling for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, every man, woman, and child, attack on
Yeah.
Iran, that the Epstein files is what might sink Trump's presidency. But again, I think you're right. I think it's probably the genocide that has turned most people against Israel, and this, I guess, just piles on, and it's it's important for those who see this as the final nail in the coffin.
And just to follow up on this interview with Max Blumenthal, who lays out the connection between Epstein and Israel and, of course, Trump, is that among the people that these frat boy influencers invited was Bassem Youssef, who took them to task and called them live on their show, called them children, and they just stood there and sat there rather, and took it basically because they were hemorrhaging followers for giving such a softball soft pitch interview to Netanyahu. Thank you for listening. We'll be talking to you next week at 2 p.m. on Wednesday at the Shai Nana Show. This is Zain al-Amin signing off.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, August 6. Here are some headlines. Today marks the 80th anniversary of the first atomic bombing. On August 6, 1945, the U.S. bomber Enola Gay dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima in Japan. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
The bomb killed somewhere around 100,000 people, leading the pilot of the Enola Gay to remark, quote, "My God, what have we done?" end quote. The bombing of Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on the 9th remain the only times nuclear weapons have been used to kill in war. The world has never seen a thermonuclear weapon detonated in war, thermonuclear weapons being a later, more complex invention which can literally be hundreds of times as powerful as the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Remembering the dead and resisting nuclear proliferation remains a strong cultural theme in Japan. In fact, the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize was given to Nihon Hidankyo, an organization founded by the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to resist nuclear arms. The organization is still fiercely advocating for a peaceful non-nuclear future, refusing to forget what happened 80 years ago, even as the last survivors pass away.
In more news, at least 135 Palestinians, including 87 seeking aid, have been killed and 771 injured in Israeli attacks across Gaza in the past 24 hours, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry also said the number of people who starved to death in the enclave during Israel's war has risen to 193. Meanwhile, the Israeli military put parts of Gaza City and Khan Yunis under new enforced displacement orders today, amid fears that the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is preparing to order expanded operations in the territory. Netanyahu is set to convene a military cabinet tomorrow, where he is expected to push for a total Israeli reoccupation of Gaza, despite serious misgivings from his own senior military officers. Critics of the plan say any push for full occupation would put the lives of Israeli hostages in Gaza at risk, could take between a year and 2 years to fully achieve, and would come at the expense of the country's increasing diplomatic isolation, with the international community already horrified by Israel's actions. And as Texas state Democrats continue to delay gerrymandering legislation by fleeing to Illinois, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has taken legal action against them. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Texas Governor Abbott's most recent move targets the state house's highest-ranking Democrat, Eugene Wu. Today, Abbott filed a petition to the Texas Supreme Court looking to strip Gene Wu of his duties. Here is Gene Wu, chair of the Texas House Democratic Office, in response.
This is just purely insanity. What we're looking at is a governor who is conspiring with a disgraced president to use unconstitutional, illegal racial gerrymandering to destroy our communities. I have a duty to respond to that. I have an obligation to do everything I can to stop that using every legal means necessary.
Removing Wu.